Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at kfai.org. Non-commercial, community-powered radio. Well, Thursdays at this time, it's the Northern Sun Radio News with your host, Don Olson, along with Dave Gudnick. And we're going to start off the show today with Vijay Prashad, who we haven't heard from for a good long time. And he'll be talking about limits to U.S. military power. He was on neutrality studies with Pascal Lattas earlier this week. And Vijay Prashad will talk about how so much of the media are just stenographers of power.
Nice to be with you, Pascal. Great to see you. Yeah.
Great having you again. I wanted to pick your brain about your analysis of the situation in 2025. I mean, we are now, today is October 22nd, and we are seeing the build-up for war in Venezuela. Everybody's expecting a second round of war in Iran, and we've seen, however, in this year, how BRICS developed, and also in the SEO and in other formats. So I wanted to know how you're making sense of what we're seeing currently in global politics.
Well, you know, let's go with your phrase about war, because it's really interesting. The United States, one of the by far largest spender on the military in the whole world, more than 50% of global military spending, the NATO plus countries, if you include Japan, the Republic of Korea, and so on, you know, close to 80% of global military spending. It's unbelievable. You know, when you put it together, when you put the per capita numbers together of how much is spent in these societies. Nonetheless, in the past decade, the United States has not really been able to capitalize on its ability to destroy countries. So, for instance, about 20 odd years ago, it was, you know, generally we watched the United States flounder in Afghanistan. You know, yes, fine. You know, Joint Chiefs, you can bomb anywhere and you can destroy any hutment of the very poor Afghan peasants. But for God's sake, you don't know how to conquer the land. You know, and that was very clear from pretty early on. Similarly, in Iraq, you know, the United States could bomb Fallujah and bomb Ramadi and drop depleted uranium on those cities, but really couldn't hold them, you know, couldn't occupy them effectively. And by the way, we're seeing the same thing with the Israelis. They can bomb Gaza from one end to the other, devastate the landscape. But, you know, once the Israeli tanks entered into Gaza and the resistance started firing back, they had to withdraw. That was you know, in 2024 January, they had to withdraw. They couldn't go into phase two of their occupation. And now they're sitting at the edges of Gaza, a lot of land that they've held. But it's not in Gaza City. It's not in Rafah. It's not in Khan Yunis. They've had to withdraw from that. They're too scared to lose lives. You know, that's the fact of it. So, yes, the United States threatening Venezuela, but with what? 150 to 200,000 Venezuelans under arms. You know, if the U.S. actually landed troops in Venezuela, it would not be as easy as they imagine. You know, they'd have to fight street by street. I don't think they're looking forward to that. I think at most the bombing here and there would be acceptable to the Joint Chiefs, but I don't think they're going to actually go to a full-scale war. We saw the same in Iran. You know, Iran has three times the population of Iraq. Yes, you can bomb from the skies. The Israelis, they're such brave people, you know. In fact, theirs is a war of cowardice, you know, bombing from the skies. But they're not going to land troops on Iranian soil. I doubt it. You know, they'll again face street by street fighting. They don't have the appetite for it. So the United States, their Israeli partners, the Europeans and all, lots of big talk, coward's way of fighting from the sky. But when it comes to really trying to take land, I don't think they have it in them. And by the way, if we think that they are going to pause before an attack on Venezuela, you can imagine the paper tiger, to quote Chairman Mao, on China. I mean, there is no way the United States is going to put even one soldier on Chinese soil.
At the same time, though, like, we are seeing this escalation of rhetoric, right? And we see how the U.S. now renamed its Department of Defense to Department of War and nonsense like that, while all at the same time, Donald Trump is trying to brand himself as the greatest peacemaker on God's green earth. But we also see how the understanding of peace is like a situation in which one side stops shooting, at least for Gaza, and the other side still keeps killing indiscriminately. And for some reason, Western media is absolutely fine with this and going along with it. We see it with Venezuela. I mean, the Western media just reports, drug boats being taken out. Are you in any way surprised by this public, like, the propaganda machine around all of these horrible, like, bloodthirsty acts?
Oh, no. I mean, the media has fallen into its own kind of sewer a very long time ago. I mean, we watched this in 2002 during the lead up to the illegal war against the Iraqi people, you know, when the New York Times, the so-called newspaper of record, effectively printed lies that were being fed to Judith Miller by the U.S. Intelligence services as if it was fact. You know, she wrote about weapons of mass destruction as if it was factual. And you can even go further back, you know, go back to the first attack on Iraq in 1991, when there were a public relations outfit that was constructing stories for the U.S. media regarding babies being thrown out of incubators and so on, much of that fabricated in order to build up for the attack on Iraq in 1991. I mean, all of this without, after the fact, a sense of shame by the media, it creates a kind of callous, you know, there is a kind of callous on top of the media. They don't seem to care. I mean, they'll report anything and everything. I mean, look at the reporting on Xinjiang. Without any care for the basic factual record, they'd say anything. You know, some time ago, a reporter once told the New York Times that, you know, I can report anything on North Korea and you'll run it. I could say that, you know, the regime's favorite dish is dogs grilled or eaten live, and you'd run it as a factual story. Doesn't matter, because verification, trying to find a second or third source, none of that has ever stopped anybody from reporting whatever they want about the wars of the United States. So, you know, when you talk about, well, the media doing this or the media doing that, I mean, we need to be very clear that these are stenographers of power. These are not journalists. I refuse to accept them as journalists.
I absolutely agree. Yet I do think we are seeing currently a change in this. I mean, the sheer fact that we have social media, the fact that we have these podcasts and so on, and also direct reporting via Facebook and whatnot, even from a genocide zone, seems to me to do something. Maybe not so much in the West, but definitely in the global South. Do you have any observation of, like, if you compare the current period with this 2002-2003 Iraq war, Afghanistan war, how is it different in the way that the global South now perceives these crimes?
Well, it's actually even in the global north. I mean, that's what provokes these big demonstrations. 250,000 people in Amsterdam, for God's sake. I mean, of all cities, you know, where there's a far-right government, and you have this huge demonstration against the genocide in Gaza, you know, people just don't believe what they are reading in the mainstream or listening, or in fact, they don't read the papers. They don't, you know, at one time we used to bemoan the fact and say, well, people aren't reading the news. It's not true. They're just not reading the garbage news. You know, they're getting their news in different places, websites, you know, podcasts like yours and so on, getting more and more popular, people willing to engage with you know, other kinds of reporting, people who have contacts on the ground or who are on the ground reporting in a different way. You know, a long time ago, Patrick Cockburn said that the best war reporting doesn't come from the front line. It comes from those who are able to assess what's happening. Sometimes in the fog of the front line, you don't get the full picture. But in fact, that's proven a little untrue in Gaza, where it is very useful to have the voices of Palestinians reporting directly, telling us directly that what they are, you know, seeing is in complete, you know, conflict with what, let's say, the New York Times is reporting and so on. So yeah, it's made a big difference. I quite agree. I wouldn't deny that it's made an enormous difference. But I also will say that you know, there is a kind of schizophrenia that we have. On the ones know that the you know, the United States, for instance, is deeply weakened even militarily. Its ability to drive history forward with military power is weakened. We know that. On the other side, we fear the US because it has such immense capacity. You know, I mean, okay, maybe the United States can't drive history forward in Venezuela with an invasion, but you know, four or five mother of all bombs dropped on Caracas would certainly have an enormous impact on the Venezuelan people, you know, on the people of Caracas. So that's the schizophrenia. We know they can't drive history forward with military force, but we know that they can really create havoc and destroy people's lives with their military force.
Yeah, I mean, Dade, it's a little bit like seeing a very big, very confused, very angry man in the street with a lot of weapons. Is like, even if you know that the guy is kind of confused, you wouldn't really want to get close, right? But we cannot get further away from the United States. The question, therefore, to me is how to, maybe not disarm, but how to calm him down. Do you have any hope for us, our global ability, to calm down the United States and tell them, look, it's going to be fine. It's going to be a multipolar world, but you'll still be an appreciated member of it. Did you see any way to do that? Do you see, like, the approach also of the Russians and the Chinese? Because I'm pretty sure they must be thinking about this.
Imagine that. Well, first, I would like people within the United States to come to a certain recognition. I think it's an important recognition. Look, you fought a 20-year war, spent over trillion U.S. dollars to overthrow the Taliban. At the end of the day, the Taliban comes back. The Israelis conducted a genocide in Gaza, killed I don't know how many people, destroyed the entire infrastructure, partly to destroy Hamas, but Hamas is back. I mean, Hamas is not going anywhere. The Taliban are not going anywhere. You know, the United States might be able to look back at its earlier examples of regime change, you know, maybe the overthrow of Saddam Hussein and so on. But those were conventional governments that were overthrown. You know, these more like sort of political forces on the ground with mass sentiment behind them can't so easily be set aside. In other words, your strategy is useless. And so you might as well come to terms with reality. I mean, there is no way that the United States, with one military push, another military push, is going to get rid of the Communist Party of China. It's not possible. It's not going to happen. The Communist Party of China is enormously popular in China for many reasons. You know, one of them is that it had been able to solve the problem of the pandemic. It has been able to get rid of absolute poverty. There has been stability in the country after the atrocious period before the Chinese Revolution, you know, a long period of warlordism that perhaps goes back to the Qing Dynasty all the way out to 1949, you know, not even till the Japanese War, but even further back, you know, before 1911. And people are like, oh my God, you know, we know that history, we don't want to return to it. So there's got to be a way for let's say, reality to seep in. That look, in some parts of the world,
and that was Vijay Prashad being interviewed by Pascal Lattes on the Neutrality Studies website earlier this week. And so I have here with me Dave Gutnick. The U.S. accepting a multipolar instead of a unipolar world, it's futile, is it not?
Well, yes, but we continue with this behavior despite defeat after defeat. And Vijay Prashad listed some of those. I want to comment on a few because they illustrate several things. One is, as he mentioned, limitations of our military power. Bombing often doesn't accomplish what it's thought to, and we rely on that a lot. I describe our stance as bribes, bullying, and bombs. And these examples I'm about to run through illustrate not only military limits, but a couple of other things that they're supported by media lies, the mainstream media. This is why the two speakers ended up talking about the value of alternative and social media, which has changed the landscape significantly, and public skepticism is growing. Nevertheless, mainstream media lies are powerful and supported every one of these warring adventures. And they're also characterized by prolonged U.S. denial of its own defeat. And finally, they're resulting in serious financial consequences, which so far we've managed to get the rest of the world to pay for. So maybe we come back to some of that. But I want to say a few things dating back to Vietnam, which he didn't mention. But, you know, this followed the French defeat. Okay, so we had already the example of the French defeat. The thing was entered and built up on false premises. Massive bombing that actually exceeded the total bombing of World War II. And again, denial of our defeat. And yet now the country's run still by the Communist Party. And in Afghanistan, the Taliban won, as was said, and 20 years of futility and murder on the part of the U.S. The heroin trade went way, way down to the Taliban. We came in there and it went way, way up again. And now with the Taliban in and the U.S. out again, it's going back down. And there is a long history of U.S. Intelligence and military people involved with drug trade, subject for a whole another program. But again, here we have denial of defeat and also important early example of sponsoring Islamic jihadists in our campaign to drive the Soviet Union out, which succeeded more or less. We created this monster. And Brzezinski said, who cares about a bunch of Arabs because we defeated Russia? And so now, of course, endless nightmares and wars have been visited upon the Mideast and the United States, often through terrorist groups that we ourselves are sponsoring, even though that's not the official story. Then there's Iraq, where we used depleted uranium and destroyed lots and lots of infrastructure. What did we gain? Madeleine Albright's infamous ugly quote said, well, that reporter asked her, what about at least a 500,000 women and children killed? And she said, well, we think it was worth it. The royal we notice, and also what's worth it? I mean, what did it do? I mean, it was, again, on false premises, and Iraq wants us to leave. We're still there. We refuse to leave. It's the denial of defeat. Look at Iran. The bombing, recent bombing, really didn't have nearly as much impact as our boastful president tried to claim it did. And it's, you know, it's unclear what we're going to achieve there. It's also built up on a bunch of media lies and, you know, denial of the changing world. And Israel experiencing failures in military strategy, as was mentioned, in Gaza is a parallel example. And want to point just briefly again to the financial aspect, because what Charles de Gaulle called the dollar's exorbitant privilege, which has existed since World War II, is what has enabled the U.S. to sponsor all these wars and go deeply into debt from all these wars, while the rest of the world is more or less paying for it by recycling their dollars, which they have to have because of trade, and we were the dominant trade character for many years. And so the rest of the world is sponsoring these wars, and we have an unpayable monumental debt based on this entire pattern, which cannot be paid, and there's going to be some huge reckoning at some point in the probable near future of unknown characters. So this financial bankruptcy we've got ourselves into is another consequence of all these wars. So finally, about Ukraine, briefly, there again, we're actually now behind on the latest missile technology as demonstrated by Russia, and behind on the latest drone technology. So we have, in case you haven't noticed, a remarkably inefficient capitalist system here in this country, which, you know, requires $600 hammers and $600 toilet seats for the airplanes, and all these military expenditures, which are vastly, grossly inflated. And so there's a financial aspect which is further bankrupting our country.
Yes, the military-industrial complex is something that President Dwight Eisenhower, when he was leaving office in 1961, warned against, and that the role of the military-industrial complex is, what the U.S. spends on war-making, war material, is, we're number one in the world, of course, and it's more than the next nine countries combined.
And the U.S. is the leader of the NATO pact, of course, and gets them to buy a lot of these things. And as Vijay Prasad mentioned, the NATO countries have 80% of the global total of the military expenditures. 80%.
80%.
That's the United States leadership.
And it's the U.S. is much more than what Russia and China spend. And it's the way the U.S. Military spending is for a lot of big high-tech things, which are very costly, which are expensive to maintain, and after years and years and often cost overruns, they do come out with them, and then they force all the allies to buy some of these planes or buy some of this equipment and the like. It's and it's done because the U.S. has the dollar, and since the end of World War II, Bretton Woods Pact, the dollar is the world's reserve currency, and so in order for the whole thing, the whole virtual world economy up until recently, with the BRICS coming to the fore, it's everything has to run through SWIFT payments, and that everything must conform to what the U.S. wants. And if you don't do it, you can't get your money going through that bank. It's in Switzerland, I believe, and it's something that is very practical. And I know we all kind of shudder that Trump and Hegseth have changed the Department of Defense to the Department of War. And this also happened after World War II. And of course, many of us would say, well, for all the years when it's been the Department of War, when it's continuous warfare on the frontier against native peoples and against oh, the Mexicans in 1847 and 1848. But the fact of it is, it was a accurate statement of what the U.S. is about, Department of War. The U.S. is there to make war, and now we can, it's much more out in the open, being the Department of War.
The problem with the hope for change scenario that Pascal and Vijay were speaking about at the end, in other words, when will the U.S. change its ways, looks dubious to me. Looks dark. I mean, there's tremendous inertia and self gain, financially and in other ways, especially by the upper 1% and upper 10%, to keep all this stuff going. And we've had official policy since the 90s, and I believe this is still the mentality that we have to fight, announced by the Project for New American Century and also in other papers at the time, that we would not countenance any rival powers. The goal was to be the sole superpower of the world, which we were for a few years, and not allow any rival powers. That was the agenda, and many of these people still live in that world and have that fantastic agenda, even though we're no longer the foremost economic power, and we're not even the foremost, despite all our spending, the foremost military power. And diplomatically, we're in last place. I mean, there's very little respect for the U.S. On that score around the country. So we're stuck in fighting the previous war, so to speak, and these people want to return to, or maybe they never recognize that we lost the sole global unit power dominance that we had for a brief period in the 1990s, and that's what they want to get back to. They want to break up and weaken Russia. They want to weaken China. And we're talking massive failure at our own expense.
The unipolar moment came after the demise of the Soviet Union. And it was during the 90s, they picked Russia clean as they could for the capitalists from Europe and the U.S.
Disaster capitalism is to coin the phrase.
That's disaster capitalism is right. And it wasn't starting to change until, Putin came to power in about the year 2000. And
Russians don't want to return to those years. Those were terrible years. Population dropped. Alcoholism and suicide went way up. Economic activity went way down. It was a terrible decade, the worst for Russia.
And the way the U.S. news is controlled. I mean, they refer to Judith Miller. Well, it was finally so obvious in the lead up to the U.S. going into Iraq for the New York Times writing, because she was just, as you said, one of the people were saying, B.J. Prashad perhaps, that it was blatantly untrue. All these reasons, justifications for going into Iraq. And then, well, eventually, she had to murmur a few lines of contrition, but it hardly made a difference, and she did leave the paper. I think it was on page 8 of the New York Times.
Yeah, but again, I want to point out to the pattern which we get into these wars, one after another, on false premises, which the mainstream media supports, to a whole packet of lies, because we have a very, very sophisticated system and history of creating these media narratives. We're very, very good. We have a powerful propaganda system, and so the Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, now Venezuela, they're all based on false premises.
And they all add up to horror.
Ukraine also.
And the Ukraine, of course, is what we've had made a particular point on this show of trying to overcome that, because the media is so well controlled that it's very strictly controlled within certain parameters about what they can, public and corporate media, can talk about in terms of what's going on, but it's we'll get into a little bit more on that, I think, with our next segment we have here. Anything more, Dave, or should we go
ahead?
No,
go ahead.
So now we want to, somebody new here, Michelle Michael Schulenburg.
Schulenburg. Well known in Europe. He was at the UN for years, and now he's a left-wing German politician, member of the EU Parliament.
And Jeffrey Sachs, who has been a long time, someone that we've relied on often for explaining the world, so he is also part of this next thing. And they're kind of talking about the topic of the craziness of European Union elites, what's going on right now. And they talk about how Europe betrays Europe by what it's going through most recently. And this was posted on October 24th.
And welcome to another Multipolar Peace Network webinar. Today with the brilliant Michael von der Schulenburg, a former UN official and current member of the European Parliament for the party of Sarah Wagenknecht, which means he's of course a German MEP. With us is also Professor Jeffrey Sachs, whose idea it was to invite Michael to talk to us about Europe, the European Union, and the many flaws of the political setup of the continent. Michael, you have as much time as you want in order to give us your introductory remarks. Tell us what's important, also what's going on at the moment. Feel free to also touch on the 80th anniversary of the UN if you like. And after that, Jeff will give us his remarks. Please, the floor is yours.
Yeah, let me first start. If you ask me where Europe is, I can just tell you I don't know. I come back from Strasbourg, where we have the plenary of the European Parliament. And we had it for a few days, and I must say, it's a shocking environment. You know, the entire parliament, even on the right and the left, there is a Russia hatred, there is a war hysteria, there is a panic. They talk about winning the war, that Russia will go down in economics, and you know, and things like this one. It's a completely unrealistic environment, and there's virtually hardly anybody who says something else, and it drowns immediately in this atmosphere of we have to stand together because otherwise we are going to lose. So it's a very, very difficult situation. I think what happens in the parliament is maybe symptomatic what happens in the EU and wider the NATO members of Europe. It's not always all Europe. So I think that's my impression, and then I would like to say a few words, but Jeff, after you say, you know, what I think, what motivates these people, and because it seems to be at first it's completely irrational, and why it is like this, why I think it is like this one, and what it means for the Ukraine and so on. Yeah. So.
Yeah, I mean, Michael, this is, I think, the big puzzle for all of us that have seen so many exit ramps for peace that have been refused by the United States. And then when the United States seems to hint that it wants an exit ramp, then refused by Europe. It's rather shocking. You and I know, because we've been watching this close up for decades, in fact, that the war in Ukraine was completely avoidable. It could have been avoided if the United States had not pressured Europe to agree to NATO enlargement to Ukraine, especially the agreement in 2008 at the Bucharest summit, which was under U.S. pressure, where German Chancellor Angela Merkel gave in the end on the second day, said, okay, we'll promise that NATO will enlarge, but she knew how provocative this is. And then if Europe had followed through on the agreement reached in the context of the Maidan protests, which were stoked by the U.S. in February 21, 2014, when actually three European foreign ministers agreed with President Yanukovych that there will be elections in 8 months, but no coup. And then Europe completely folded its hands. Then in 2015, when there was the Minsk agreement to end what had become an incipient war that was based on the idea of regional autonomy for the ethnic Russian-speaking region of eastern Ukraine, modeled, by the way, on South Tyrol in Italy. So nothing extraordinary, but autonomy of two oblasts. And then again, Europe and the United States said, yeah, you don't have to follow through on that. And then the United States, during the first Trump term, building a million-person army in Ukraine, the biggest in Europe, and an army that was shelling Donetsk City, shelling the Donbas, and the Russians saying, look, just stop NATO enlargement, enforce the Minsk agreement. But again, the U.S. and Europe not listening to this. And then the Biden administration urging Ukraine not to sign any kind of peace agreement. You've written brilliantly about this, but Zelensky, first as an elected president, now as a martial law dictator, in effect, in my view, under the U.S. auspices, pushing for more war. Then Trump comes in, and it looks like he wants an exit ramp to say, okay, stop the war. Ukraine will be neutral. And then Europe jumps up and down saying, no way, no way. That's giving in. That's appeasement. It's weird. So we are in full-fledged war right now. Europe has rejected any exit ramp starting back in 2008. Don't have NATO enlargement. In 2014, don't have a coup. In 2015, enforce the Minsk II agreement. In 2022, agree on Ukraine's neutrality. Europe, at every stage, has been a warmonger. And you see, for the politicians, and this is my question to you, Michael, this doesn't work politically for them. You look at Starmer in the UK, his approval rating is 20%, disapproval 80%. You look at Macron, it can't even go lower. It's a statistical error, 13% approve him, 87% disapprove him. 13% agree on anything in our universe. Then you look at Merz. His approval rating is plummeting also. It's in the 30s. Yeah. It's higher than the
others. No, it's now below the 30s. And, you know, it's very rare in Germany that that happens. Yeah.
So the question is, what is the motivation of this? It's not popular politics. It's not driven by the public saying, we want war. Is it the military-industrial complex? Somebody wrote to me a brilliant sociological analysis saying the they call it the armed class, this sociologist in Italy, saying it's a kind of class struggle. It's the so-called professional army or the money-making military. Is that it, or is it... is it that these leaders don't know what to do? They forgot all about diplomacy? They're really afraid? So what motivates this? You see this every day, Michael, and you're the best analyst of this. What is going on in Europe?
You know, Jeff, it's something which bothered me a lot of times. You know, of course, I watched it all the time since we had the conflicts in 2014 starting and things like this one. And if you look at the European Union, it remained relatively calm on the whole thing. It followed the British and the Americans, but it didn't really have a much of an own position. It is very sudden that the European Union, and then in combination with Great Britain, of course, sort of completely changed its stance and tries to take a leadership that something doesn't happen. Russia cannot win this war in Ukraine. They see this as an existential threat to them. I don't see it like this. They do. And it has something to do with their plan. I think how people, and I follow this in the discussion here, and I see, of course, a lot of these people. The interesting thing is, I think the rationale
by these political elites is that it is in the multipolar world, the European Union should become one of the big powers. You know, that's also the militarization now and all the rest of it. It should become the, and it cannot be Russia. And what they see now in this war, that Russia might be in future the third, still the small one, big power, and Europe is losing it. It's very interesting what happens in this year. I mean, we constantly invite in the parliament leaders from outside. There was just briefly the president of Moldova, and she, you know, and she came and spoke here, Mrs. What's her name, Sandu, and she was received by all with standing ovations. She, when she said, no, we belong to Europe and our people are for Europe, although they just cheated enormously in the elections, no, all ignore these cheats. Actually, our party is the only one who went there on monitoring and to say, you know, this is the cheated elections. All the rest say that was a perfect election. It's a sign of democracy, a sign of people wanting to live with the West and things like this one. Then we have the Prime Minister of Greenland coming. Same thing again when he said, you know, we belong to Europe and not to the United States. You know, standing ovation. You know that we have to round up Europe. We had the opposition leader of Belarus recently. I mean, 3 days ago, and he said the same thing, that they actually have the majority in Belarus, and over there soon we have the elections, we will come to you and push Russia into Asia. And you know, they all stand up and clap. I mean, as you know, Jeff, what the project really is, and I have a lot, is that we want to enlarge the European Union as quickly as we can, because we see we are in competition with Russia, who controls it on one side, and a competition on Greenland with the United States. Mm. It is an elitist project of saying we have to become larger, we have to come. You know, there was recently also von der Leyen spoke to Serbia and say, you have to make up your mind, you have to come on our political line with Russia. You can't support Russia, you must be to our, what we call our common policy. So I think this, we see there is a huge thing. There's a lot of discussion that these countries should be taken into the European Union. We should not follow the Copenhagen criteria for this, because under these criteria, none of these countries could possibly come to the European Union. We should bring them in, and then we will see and we work it out. There's yesterday, or was it before yesterday, we voted on a proposal, and the majority said yes, a proposal to take the, to have majority voting only in the European Union. That means the unanimity principle is going to be dropped. We want this, these troublemakers, we like Hungary and maybe soon also the Czechs and the Slovaks, we want to have them out. We want to decide, and the new members would also not get full voting rights. I mean, this whole thing is made to make now, as quickly as possible, a mammoth EU that includes, of course, Ukraine, Moldova. In this, all this, we still mention Georgia. We hope we get Georgia also in. We speak about the West Balkan, Serbia, essentially, and, of course, Greenland. And this is now, yeah, that's now, since the beginning of this year, this is a big issue. We now interfere into elections in order to prevent that some opposition is, like in Romania. We intervened in the election heavily in Moldova, in Georgia, and things like this one. So we do all these type of what the Americans used to do, these regime change, internal interference, internal affairs, in order to have a situation where Europe could be enlarged, could be...
Well, there it is, the EU. Well, we've talked about how they've been suffering because of the way some of the U.S. Policies, blowing up the Nord Stream natural gas pipelines, which really affected the German economy, but also others in Europe. And the U.S. applies at much higher rates for these hydrocarbons, but it's all structured around tightening the noose around Russia.
Yeah, I was going to get to that, but in the context of what Mr. Schulenburg just summarized, and I think he missed one key element, which Don's comment indicates, but want to mention the other two first, which is, first of all, there's a powerful military-industrial class. The armed class has close relations between the U.S. MIC and the Europeans in their military-industrial complex. So this is powerful forces, powerful motivation, politically and financially, to, pursue their agenda of developing more weapons and engaging in more armed conflicts. So that's an important factor. They have a military-industrial complex over there as well, closely allied with our own, although subordinate to it. Secondly, some of them now have big power dreams, and this was touched upon at the end there, where the EU, originally strictly an economic alliance, has grown increasingly militaristic and centralized and a powerful force for globalist politics, which a lot of nations and parties are now rejecting or at least questioning. And then thirdly, there's the long-term U.S. Antagonism or disruption of European dependence on Russia, and this is where the gas pipeline business comes in. But it's important to understand this geopolitical context is quite a few years old, and I've mentioned on the previous show that in the 1980s we were working against European dependence on Russian gas, and through a very devious indirect means had bots placed in their pipelines. This is another one of these nefarious years in the planning type thing, and had explosions in their first major gas pipeline trying to delay or prevent this. So again, the strategy is to weaken Russia, but also to weaken European dependence on Russia and increase their dependence on the United States financially in ways that I mentioned earlier with the dollar dominance and the exorbitant privilege, which has them reinvesting in the U.S. because they have to buy all our weapons and commodities with dollars, so they have to invest their dollars somewhere, and they invest them in the U.S. And this way we've had the whole world, or much of it, paying for our wars, and we're going further and further into debt, but I don't think it'll ever be paid. So, again, the campaign against European dependence on cheap Russian fuel has been going on for many, many years and culminated, you could say, in the current war and in the destruction 3 years ago of the Nord Stream pipeline, which had fueled German and other economic thriving.
It is logical. I mean, how close Russia is and how willing they were to integrate, and they were doing that. And the U.S. Was starting to be a little bit concerned that the European Union, under the leadership of Germany and France, might be a little bit outside the control of the U.S. They might have a little bit different point of view, maybe even trying to balance Russia and the U.S. So they had to be brought under control of the U.S. again, and this has been a long-term program of what the U.S. was going to try and accomplish.
But also there are these reasons, as Schulenburg and Sachs were discussing, why the European leaders have been increasingly pro-war and building up threats of war and trying to increase their military expenditures. And it's probably not going to work. They cannot afford it, just to put it most directly. Their economies are in trouble, and politically the leadership's in trouble, as was mentioned by the speakers. So to me, their European involvement, if they think they're going to get it, I don't think it's actually going to happen. In Ukraine, they're looking at another defeat. So it's, again, illustrating limits to some of the military strategists and bombing campaigns that we've relied on and that they backed fully. I think the Brits are going to be the hard nut to crack. They are the most Russophobic and most deeply involved in the Ukraine war and in intelligence and sabotage type activities and assassinations and so on. And we inherited a lot of that from the Brits, and they're our closest ally in these kind of behind-the-scenes war-making activities.
Yes, the British MI6, their foreign intelligence and controlling unit has been involved in the recent war in the Ukraine quite a bit, along with the CIA, and has been pointed out by us here over the last couple of weeks that the decisions are made by of the Ukraine, what's going to happen, are made by U.S. generals in Germany. That's where they're stationed. That's where they make it. And so this is all of a U.S. How they're assessing it, what they're doing, testing out rockets, or as former Secretary of Defense under Biden said, they want to weaken Russia. They can draw it out. And it's, Dave, you have a article in the Veterans for Peace News for fall on the 100-year war on Russia. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it's more like 200 years in the case of our instructors, our colonial masters, the British. But in our case, it went on actively in a provocative, militarily destructive way with the multiple allies who invaded Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution and tried to overthrow the Bolsheviks and were defeated, of course. But that was the beginning of what I see as a continuous 100-year war to weaken Russia, to make war on Russia, and things in the same vein. And, of course, they were officially our ally to defeat the Nazis, and they bore the brunt of the war by far, just as China bore the brunt of the war by far in the East.
Against Japan.
Against Japan. And we are in our fierce anti-communism, which I believe is driving this war that I'm talking about, because Russia represented, on official terms, a socialist form of government, and it's basically all about whether we're going to share and distribute the wealth and to what degree are we going to share and distribute the wealth. And the big threat to the capitalist powers, which run most everything, is sharing the wealth. And so I believe this is the fundamental ideological, financial, strategic basis for our continuous war on Russia. And I want to mention specifically that even in World War II, before 1945, U.S. and British leaders, including Churchill and including some U.S. generals, started discussing whether we should invade Russia before the war was even over, because the agenda, again, was long-term to weaken and attack Russia and a possible overthrow or achieve regime change. So, of course, since World War II, it's been as clear as ever that we're on this campaign. And that's why I call it a 100-year war. And our leaders and the NATO leaders and our political leaders have stated repeatedly that it's not about Ukraine, that it's about weakening Russia and achieving regime change. So we need to think a little beyond the headlines to understand why we're in this war and repeatedly in these wars.
I think it was last week that we, Star Tribune had an Associated Press article about what's going on there, that the Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, said that Trump was giving a distorted view of what had been agreed to back in Alaska as to what was going to happen and some of the conversations, telephone conversations that Trump had had. So you really have to not just rely on those headline news that come every hour, but you got to read a bit more about that, and that's what we try and provide in this show.
Well, unfortunately, there is some alternative in social media now that didn't used to exist. And so in some important respects, the media landscape is better for finding and seeking out dissident voices. Noam Chomsky said the same thing. He says that things were much worse in the 60s as far as media narrative control. So there's opportunity out there, but most people are stressed out and very busy and don't have a lot of time to get beyond the mainstream media. And while we got a couple more minutes here, I want to go back to one point that Vijay Prasad was speaking about, Venezuela, and the pattern. Again, I tried to describe the pattern of U.S. strategy of media lies, and bribing and bullying and bombing. And also there's an element that I didn't mention, that it often starts very incrementally. You know, we're just sending in a few advisors, right? And then there's a few more advisors, and there's arms, and then there's more weaponry, and so on and so on. Vietnam built up that way, and there's other examples of that kind of buildup. And I want to point to Venezuela because they're saying, of course, if it's only 10,000, that's a lot, but 10,000 is not going to be enough to invade and control a country like Venezuela. But there's this incremental element, so you got to watch out for there's going to be possibly some big incident where a bunch of our people get killed, and that'll be an excuse to escalate the whole thing. And the second thing about the number of ships and men, which, again, is not sufficient to control a very large country, which is going to have fierce resistance by the population that's loyal to the
Maduro
and the whole Chavez tradition. But one thing to remember is that Venezuela has, of course, possibly the world's largest oil reserves, mostly offshore in the Orinoco Basin, and their oil rigs are almost all offshore, and they never installed their own refining capacity because this oil industry was built up to serve U.S. interests, and the refining goes on in Houston and places like that. And so Venezuela is dependent or weakened in that way. But I want to point out that we may have an initial strategy of simply seizing control of the offshore oil rigs, which wouldn't take a million people. And then, of course, it'll go and get worse from there. But I'm just saying this could be one tactic to start the war. And once these things start, they're pretty hard to control.
Yes, it's kind of jaw-dropping how many boats are just blowing up in the middle of the...
Outrageous outlaw nation. But just consider what it'll be like if we do this big action in Venezuela and then somebody or other sets fire to some of the oil fields. Remember Kuwait? It was horrible.
It was a tremendous amount of destruction of oil fields and pollution and the like. Well,
it's about oil. They want regime change. It's not about drugs.
Unfortunately, it's and right now, even though a number of people called for proving that these boats are carrying
We don't care.
But it's well, this has been the Northern Sun Radio News Show with your host Don Olson and Dave Gudnick with me today. And next it'll be Global Beat with Doug.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
Any questions?
Where's the scariest place you've ever been?
Scariest place I've ever been? Maybe St. Cloud, Minnesota, where the crazed war widow threw her baby down a well. I mean, it's thick.
That's a segment from the film 1408. Based off a Stephen King short story. Who knew St. Cloud was such a fright? Certainly not St. Cloud. The story seems to have popped from the imagination of the screenwriter. However, the cast of Travel Channel's Ghost Hunters did roll into nearby Sauk Center to investigate the Palmer House.
some of these experiences that not only you yourself are having, but a lot of other people are all kind of dark-natured.
I feel surrounded. I feel...
Whoa.
Built early in the 20th century, the hotel has been attracting paranormal investigators and ghostly tenants for years.
We felt you. We documented your presence. Can you show us who you are?
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at MN90.